You're listening to the Social Work Me podcast with your hosts, Matt Barnes and Julie Carter.
Welcome to another episode of the Social Work Me podcast with your host, Matt Barnes. Man, am I excited to be back with you podcasting, sharing another interview that I did during this quarantine season. And this episode is packed full of great wisdom and insight and information from my amazing guest, Eric Pierney, who is a registered psychotherapist and a certified sex addiction therapist, and the founder of Men's Therapy Toronto. On this episode, Eric and I are talking about all things men's therapy. Everything from sexuality, sex addiction, emotions, and awareness of emotions, to healthy masculinity and patriarchy. We even talk a little bit about doing some of our own work in therapy. And throughout the episode, Eric shares a whole lot of great wisdom and tips and tricks for working with men in therapy. And so if you're a counselor, a therapist, a social worker, a mental health practitioner, and you work with men, this episode is for you. I hope you enjoy this episode, and as always, would love to hear any feedback you have. And if you want to reach out to us or follow us on Instagram and Facebook, you can find us just under the handle SocialWorkMe. And just a few quick words from our sponsor, Owl Practice, who has been so influential in my practice and just making life easy. So with so many practice management options available, it can be really hard to know who to trust with your data. Owl Practice takes the security of your data really seriously. Their servers are located in Toronto and Montreal. They use bank-level encryption, and your data is continuously backed up. The entire Owl Practice team is located in Canada. As a Canadian company for Canadian mental health practitioners run by Canadians, the thing, it literally doesn't get any more Canadian. All Social Work Me listeners will get their first month free with Owl using the promo code SocialWorkMe. So head over to owlpractice.ca/socialworkme.php for more details and to get your first month free. With that being said, let's get to the show with our guest, Eric Pierney from Men's Therapy Toronto.
This podcast is brought to you by Southwest Counseling Services and Julie Carter Counseling Services.
How does that make you feel?
Don't social work me.
But I think, I think today it'll be great to touch on your practice, and I love what you're doing in Toronto and really, you know, gearing your practice for men, making it welcoming and it seems like a warm environment. I haven't been there, but just from, you know, the website and social media and everything. And I also love your mission statement that I want to touch on at some point, just about encouraging men to consider psychotherapy as a profession. I think that's so unique and so progressive. So I think we should talk about that at some point, but maybe we could just start with what does your practice look like now? What's life like during this pandemic? Catch us up to speed with what you're up to these days.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. The pandemic has been a situation where we've still been pretty busy. So we're doing everything obviously virtually as a result of the CRPO. The men is interesting in terms of how they're experiencing the pandemic. The thing that I don't know if you've noticed, is that men that were regularly coming in with chronic anxiety, a lot of the men, or I'm going to say of the ones I work, their anxiety has actually reduced. Because a lot of them, the anxiety is about something negative that's going to happen in the future. And now it's here. And life is not that bad. And it's a really interesting thing. I have a client later today who's one of those things. So, but in terms of my practice, we're doing everything virtually. It's still been pretty busy. For me, it's actually been a really a nice experience. I've been just focused on my business. I've been doing everything from my home, and it's been pretty fun.
That's awesome. Yeah. And we had chatted on the phone. You were mentioning you are taking some time right now to really focus on social media, putting out some content, and the marketing aspect of things, which I assume, you know, your experience at eBay and Kijiji, that's sort of maybe comes naturally to you.
No, it's actually the inverse. I was just talking about this. So in my practice, I do a lot of work around shame. And I have my own shame personally about putting myself out there. So for the longest time, what I did with social media is I used my own defense, and I would say I hate social media, which there's a part of it that's accurate, right? But the more truthful thing to say is I'm afraid of it. I'm just afraid of, I don't know, there's something about being exposed in that type of way. And so I really, really resisted it. But we have this wonderful practicum student who started, and he's been so gentle and so compassionate, and he's just always nudging me till he finally helped me come to my own awareness of the shame. I didn't realize it fully. And so now I'm making a commitment, as we do in work in our practice, about my commitment to start challenging it if I really want to change my life. And so I'm challenging this part. So now we have a whole strategy in place, and we started literally like weeks ago. And so I'm super excited. And actually, the person that I launched Kijiji with, her name is Janet Bannister. She saw today that I liked something on her Twitter account, and she sent me an email. She's like, "Eric, you're on Twitter. This is so exciting." So so that's been part of my intention. It's been an area that I really struggled with. The business suffered actually as a result, but I'm glad to be starting to really challenge it. So that's why.
Well, that's really interesting, and I appreciate you sharing that. I guess in my mind, I think of people in the tech field as being so open and comfortable with social media. But maybe that's just not the case. Can you go back? Can you tell us a little bit about how you got to this point? Because you have a really interesting path to private practice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was involved in the corporate world, and, you know, things were going really well. But as I was growing up, I always had this idea, like, success is going to make me feel better. That was kind of like my mantra. And so whether it meant more money, whether it meant going higher in the ranks. And I had that really uncomfortable experience where I started to get both more success and more money, and coming to terms with that's not going to change things. And during this process, I was starting to do my own internal work. I was seeing therapists. I was going to groups. I just knew something wasn't right. And then I sat back and I remember I was literally laying in bed and I was thinking about, where is this all going to go? And I'm thinking my professional career. And I had some issues that I was working on and struggling with. And I'm like, I'm just going to make more money and get higher positions, but these issues won't fundamentally go away if I don't really take a hard look at them. So that was the kind of groundwork. So then I started doing my internal work. And in my case, I was managing a large team, about 20 people. And the majority were men because we were in tech. And I started noticing that where I was getting a lot of what I was enjoying was our one-on-ones. And then I would do this thing with the guys on my team, is I would have a piece of blank piece of paper, and I'd have a scale, 0 to 10. And I'd say, I'm a manager, so I want them to fulfill their potential in the work. And so I would say, where do you think you are at fulfilling your potential? So 10 is you're giving everything you've got and you're really fulfilling your potential in your job. 0 is you're not at all. And so then they'd give me a number. Let's say they'd say, I'm 6 out of 10. And then I would say, well, whatever we're missing, that's going to be creating some pain. So I wanted to understand, what did they need to go from a 6 to a 7, 8, 9, and 10? And almost every time, what they needed had nothing to do with work. Hmm. So for example, let's say one of my guys, an example I'll share is that his wife, they had a newborn, and his wife was breastfeeding. This was 10 years ago, okay? But the challenge is she couldn't leave the baby alone. And so there was a lot of stress in the household because then he was at work. And I was like, Phil, do you just need to work from home? And like back then, it wasn't as common. And he's like, well, can I do that? I was like, if this is going to help, right? So then what we did, it was a system where 2 days a week he was working from home. A simple thing like that kind of increased his productivity. Then the trust between us really grew. But then what I started to notice is that all the people I was talking with, the thing that was keeping them from really fulfilling their potential was something on a personal side. And then I got more interested in excavating, like, what is that all about? And so, because that's what I had done for me. And I, at the time, I was, you know, going to therapists, finding a therapist, I was doing groups, I was literally doing everything. And all of that work was starting to come together. But with that said, when I left, you know, this is the biggest misunderstanding in terms of what comes in my office. When I left, I was happy. Like, I love my job. I love tech. I love everything about it. I didn't leave because I was unhappy. I never thought that way. I just felt like it was time and I wanted to do something else. At the time, I didn't know what the something else was. So I just took a risk, but I was very happy. I was so happy that they wanted me to stay. So they offered me what they call a retention package. I was supposed to leave in April. They're like, we'll pay you extra if you leave in August or July. I was like, okay, great. You know what I mean? It was like a perfect situation, right? And so I had done that. And then, I left. And the first thing I did, my mom and dad live in Montreal. And I was like, man, I don't even know them really anymore. And I just wanted to get to know them. So I went back to Montreal and I lived with my parents for 6 months. And I'm telling you, Matt, like, I don't know if you've ever done it, but like, go with your dad and like, dad, how do you buy clothes? And so my dad takes me to Walmart, you know what I mean? And I'm seeing him, like, he's looking in the mirror at like a sweatshirt. I literally, my eyes start to well up because I see this man. I was like, I don't know that side of you. You know what I mean? And then we would go for coffees. They're like just like, what are you interested in? Or then I, like again with my father, I see him, he's playing like checkers on the computer with like a friend, you know, an anonymous friend. He's like, dad, I didn't even know you had that world. And then my mom, she would just like to go for coffees and chat. So I did that for 6 months. My whole intention is I just want to get to know my parents better. That was the intention there. And then I thought I wanted to start a company because I was like, I love business. I like starting a company. And so what I started doing is I started flying to Silicon Valley in San Francisco. I started meeting with startups because I thought to myself, these guys are not going to be interested in Canada. So I'm like, what I'll do is I'll steal one of these ideas and I'll just bring it to Canada. That was the kind of, that was the idea, right? That was just the concept. So I went back maybe 4 or 5 times. Now, during this whole process, I've always been introspective and I've been journaling a lot, that whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. And I sat and I was like, what's the intention of wanting to do this? And I realized the intention was all about like being able to put on LinkedIn that I was a CEO, being able to show others that I was something. And I was like, oof, this is not going to work. And then I remember where I was, and I've literally been writing journals since 1997, every day. Okay. And so I remember where I was and I was like, shit, you're probably a therapist just because this is what you've done. And I was so upset. I was like, no way. I'm not a therapist. Like, I remember that dialogue. I was like, come on, man. I've had a successful business career. My friends are going to laugh. This is ridiculous. I want nothing to do with this. And then the voice keeps coming back. But Eric, that's what you're good at. In terms of all the things you're potentially good at, this is probably the one that you're most natural at, meaning this introspective work, understanding the kind of feelings landscape, and then just a man in terms of, it's where I just remember my most joy, you know, in terms of being a boy and being with everybody, you know, just that team, like that locker room, which as an adult male is so painful because those, so many men yearn to have that feeling back, but we don't have a lot of avenue for that. So that's basically the story. I know I spoke a lot, but that's kind of how that.
That's a really cool story. And I guess is part of being a therapist or recognizing that you would be a good therapist, did part of that come from being a client and seeing a therapist? Is that?
No, I think that's where the kind of interest developed.
Yeah.
Because I just, you know, I forget now when I meet clients for the first time. The first time I walked into a therapist's office, I was 21 years old. I was a young, young buck. And I remember like not knowing what the hell was going on. But then I remember a specific day where I shared something with the therapist, which I had promised myself I would never share with another human being. Like I assumed this would be a lock and it would stay there.
Yep.
And, you know, that experience was whatever it was. And then one day the therapist told me, and I was in Montreal, and a therapist had some broken English and said, "You're very rich." And I thought she was implying financially. But then when I realized she wasn't, it was almost like the first time someone had like given me, without any attachment, like some type of acknowledgement. And the feeling was like, I almost started to cry. I was like, you think I'm like me? And I'm looking around like, what is it about me? You know what I mean? And so, and then that was starting to feel like, wow, this is such an amazing kind of sacred environment, you know? And so that sowed the seeds for me being really interested in this type of work.
Mm, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's such a cool path. And then I guess at some point you go back to school and start back as a student after developing Kijiji and being a part of eBay. And
I hated it. That, yeah. That was a necessary evil. Yeah. I did not like being, I'm not a fan of the academic environment. I prefer the business world because the business world is so upfront. It's like, I'm here to make money. I'm here to go higher in my career. And there's something comfortable about that. The academic career is a little bit nebulous. It's like they use their intellect as a weapon. You know what I mean? It's not my cup of tea, but it was enjoyable in terms of, you know, learning all the modalities of change, figuring out which modality would be more resonant with me. And so that was part of the process.
That's awesome. Yeah. And so is that where you got exposed to sex addiction and porn addiction and doing that type of therapy and working with shame? Is that really where that stemmed from?
Yeah. What happened was I was sitting in, you know, I had this feeling to do this type of work. And then when I didn't realize, you know, the gender difference in the program, like I didn't know that going in. I was like, whatever it is. Right. And then I'm sitting there and I realize, oh shit, I'm like the only guy in the classroom. Like maybe there's another guy in the classroom. And then everything I'm thinking about is from like a male point of view, right? And so then what I did is all my topics of interest, all my research topic were men's mental health. And with men, if you're not addressing sexuality, you're going to miss the boat, right? So most men, if they're struggling with something, often it will show up in their sexuality, right? So I'll have so many men that have seen other therapists, whether male or female, but the therapist find it sometimes a little dicey to go and start asking about what are they doing with their sexual energy. And often there's going to be, you know, porn use that they're uncomfortable with, maybe infidelity, or even just an energy about themselves sexually that they're not comfortable with. Like hey, why can't, you know, I have a conversation with another individual without sexualizing it? You know what I mean? Like that type of stuff. And so that's where that whole kind of entered everything. And then I did a lot of work on sexual trauma. And so sexual trauma in men, which is like 1 in 6, which is so is enormous. If you calculate in the world, we're talking about like over 60, 70 million men have had experienced sexual trauma. Usually how they're going to manifest that is their sexual behavior is either going to be compulsive or anorexic. And so a lot of my work was, you know, in that area, a lot of the research, Then I did the certification for a certified sex addiction therapist that kind of reinforced everything I had learned. And so that was the process.
Right on. Well, maybe we could, can we dive a little bit more into sex addiction therapy?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. And I guess I'm interested in, you know, I don't think it's ever really taught maybe what's healthy or what's the optimal sexual, I don't know what the word is, sexual energy routine or dispensing of that. Like what is, what's the model that we want to be kind of basing healthy relationships and healthy sexual relationships around?
Well, that's the beauty of it, that there is nothing that's normative in that. Right. And that's what you bring up is one of the first places I will go with clients in terms of what is that for you? Right. So everyone that's different. Right. So I call it like kind of your sexual integrity. Right. So, for example, maybe some client in the bedroom, they're engaging with their partner, like having dirty talk. Let's just say more raunchy type of thing. But the challenge is they're not expressing to their partner. So my client, the male client, is not expressing to their partner that they're really uncomfortable with this. They're doing this because they feel it's what the partner wants, right? And so it's that type of, right? Because sexuality is fun, enjoyable, and fluid. I mean, you might be a man who's attracted to women, but you want to, you know, have fun with men and you have fun with men. All of that is all on the table and super, super fun and fluid, as long as it's within your sexual integrity. So I'm never going to be defining an individual's sexual integrity, what they come with. When they're coming to me, it's because within themselves, they have this feeling there's something problematic about this. And sometimes we'll unpack that to see, is it the way they're looking at it? Or is there something problematic?
Okay.
Right. Maybe it's like it's an old paradigm of like you shouldn't be masturbating or you shouldn't be watching porn, and it's not really an issue. Or on the other side, no, this is problematic because there are consequences.
Right.
Right. And they're medicating difficult emotions. But I never define what the sexual integrity is.
Nice. No, that's a good way to put that in terms of integrity. I mean, that word is packed. But I think, you know, in terms of addiction, at least in my mind, the simplest way that's ever been put to me is addiction is a maladaptive way of self-soothing. So I guess I'm not sure if you have a better definition or maybe there's something more comprehensive than that.
I would actually go even simpler than that in terms of how I speak to men about it, right? Really getting them sold on the addiction is the symptom. If they do not buy into the idea that the addiction is a symptom, they're going to go down a really bad rabbit hole because, you know, the problem, you know, obviously would be the negative core beliefs or the shame connected with, in my case, what I see is so much trauma, not always trauma, or maybe not always big T trauma, but we're going to see, you know, abuse, physical abuse, emotional neglect, right? But the thing that I need my clients to really buy in on is that it's the symptom, not the problem, because they have spent so much time trying to stop the symptom. And more than that, they're so convinced that once they stop the symptom, their life's going to be better. And I got to get them to be so sold on there's no connection, you know, and I use the metaphor, like, let's say you're addicted to porn. Well, you can go live up north in the Yukon, where in an area where there's no access to internet. And for 5 years, you can be there and you're not going to have any access to pornography. Nothing about you is going to change because you haven't worked on the problem. So the day you come back to whatever big city, whether it's, you know, high broadband internet, you're going to go back to it. Right. And so for guys to really get sold. So that's how it's identical to what you're saying. But they need to be bought in on that because they've connected their behavior with them being bad.
Right.
But they have, it's hard for them to separate that they're doing something that's not great, but doesn't mean they are not great. Right. The shame is so intertwined.
That's a good point. And do you find that men will come in and be open about having a sex addiction or a porn addiction, or does it come in kind of like, well, I've got chronic anxiety or I'm depressed. And then as you start digging, you discover this?
My case is a little bit different because they're generally coming to me because they know that that's an area that I'm comfortable talking about, right? And so they have that openness. But for therapists that may be listening, like, telltale signs are if they're starting to say, like, discernment issues. So they're starting to say stuff like, I'm not sure I'm with the right partner. I don't know if I'm attracted to her anymore. And you could get caught in that loop where you're just talking about this discernment. But then if you go a little lower, you'll notice that something's going on in the bedroom with them. Maybe he's avoiding sex with her. Maybe something's happening there, right? And so what men will typically do is going to be so uncomfortable to say something's off with me. So they'll just get stuck in this pattern. There's something with my partner. She's not right. I'm not attracted to her anymore, or something like that. And so if you see a discernment issue, so in terms of I'm not with the right partner, I would really invite a therapist to start going down and seeing how they're expressing their sexual energy, because something is probably off there. Either they're compulsive about it, or either the flip side to sexual addiction is, which I see a lot of, is sexual anorexia. Both are fear of intimacy, ultimately.
I've never heard the term sexual anorexia. What, can you break that down a little bit?
Yeah, so there are so many men that, because of their shame, there's intense fear of sex. Usually what happens is they'll have a compulsive behavior with people they have no relationship with. And then with their primary partners, they're going to be anorexic. So they're going to have distancing strategies. They're going to kind of just try to avoid sex. At the core, it's that fear of intimacy. So what they'll do is they'll be like, I'm tired tonight. Or they'll kind of, if they know there's a time when that's when they would usually have sex, they'll figure out a way to kind of not be there or do something different. And then the partner gets so confused about what's going on here. Is this about me? Is there something going on? And so sexual anorexia is it's the same shame, negative core belief about your feeling about yourself, and you distance yourself. And the other side of the coin is sexual addiction, where you're still feeling all that pain, but now what you do is compulsive, kind of more transactional sex, meaning that there's no risk of exposure because you don't care about the person and the person doesn't care about you.
Makes sense. There's no attachment. There's no fear of rejection, I guess, or fear of shame or the impacts of that.
Exactly. Nothing to be found out.
I love how you asked that question of how do you, what do you do with your sexual energy? Or I think that's a great question. That leaves it. It's such an open-ended question.
Yeah. I mean, the way I'll always do it in session is I break it out. So I'll say, what do you do with your sexual energy with your primary partner? Right. And so what I'm looking for, is there any sexual dysfunction, which is a telltale sign of potentially something going on, maybe in their history. I'm looking for who initiates sex. I'm looking for frequency, not because frequency says anything, but I'm looking for, are they in a conspiracy of silence where they're actually not having sex and neither partner is really talking about it? And then what I do is I say, hey, what are you doing with your sexual energy outside of your primary partner? And that opens up so much interesting stuff because, you know, it could be porn. It could be what they're doing on social media. It could be dating apps. It could be, you know, when they're out and about, you know, so I'll just prompt. How about when you're out and about, are you noticing yourself doing anything? And then we start to see if there's some type of issue present. And with this type of work, you know, particularly, you know, fantasy is super important. So what a guy fantasizes about doesn't come out of the blue. It's connected with something they're struggling with. So I will always say, you know, I give all my clients the opportunity. I put the hand up to say, if you're not ready to share, please don't share and we'll come back to it. But for anybody listening as a therapist, it's really important. So what I'll do is I'll address what are the kind of two categories. One, what's the most category that you find yourself drawn to? You know, maybe it's amateur stuff or whatnot. And then I'll introduce the concept of a surprise category. Something you don't always watch when you're watching pornography, but when you do watch it, you're a bit surprised that there's something about this that attracts you to it. And there's so much interesting stuff that comes up there that is important information, because that's where a lot of their shame sits. Right. So it could be they're caught up in incest fantasies. It could be transsexuals, which, of course, there's no problem with any of that. It's about, you know, where is that coming from with them?
That's interesting. And I think, you know, I've talked about this on another episode, but Pornhub releases their top 10, you know, categories every year. And it seems, for whatever reason, I guess taboo is exciting, and there's an entertainment factor to it, but it seems that incest porn continuously is, you know, one of the top categories.
I didn't realize that. No, that comes in the office quite a bit.
Does it?
Yeah, it does. You know, and obviously I'll do the work to see if there's any of that in their history. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't.
At what point are you going through their sexual development history?
So, I mean, the way I structure it, because we have the reasons that they're coming into the office for, a lot of times they're coming for like sex and porn addiction. So they've been upfront that they think they have a problem. So in the first session, I will most likely do just the how they're expressing their energy, right? Just to kind of figure out like what's going on here. Then there's a couple of assessments that we do that are part of me being a certified sex addiction therapist. And so then we assume that, okay, maybe this is a problem. Then we address some just behavioral things. Like, what are we going to do from an addiction point of view? So that might take a few sessions. But then what's really important is what I do is a detailed sexual history. And so this is kind of like the first time for them to see their sexual history completely mapped out. Right? So this is like from the earliest sexual memory, you know, maybe they saw their parents, you know, they opened the door and they saw their parents having sex and they closed the door quickly, like a memory like that, all the way to what's gone on now. And then I make sure that all the significant inflection points are there. Like, where, how did you learn to masturbate? When was the first time you saw pornography? When's the first time you did anything with another human being, whether it was play doctor or whatnot, first kiss? And then, you know, first time you lose your virginity, and then really important to see if anything happened. Was there sexual dysfunction? Oftentimes, men can't finish, which is just as unbearable for a man as someone who can't get an erection, right? And it's often misunderstood how painful that is for a guy. I will make sure to do that. That'll probably take a couple of sessions to. And so what we're always looking for is how they've come to learn about their sexuality, any patterns, negative core beliefs.
Oh, that's great. And I think it sounds like you have a good screening or intake process. So you have a little bit of an idea of what's going on before they come in.
Yeah.
How does that look? How does your intake process look? And maybe any tips you have for therapists that are working in this area?
I mean, it's a little different now, because what we do is we have a practicum student on the team. And so the request will come in and then he's going to have a first call, 30 minutes. And so what we're looking for is we're looking for extent of the issue and then motivation, just to see, is this client like really wanting to do the work or what's going on? And it's pretty basic intake. If the client, when they originally contact us, they have a few options as to why they're coming. And so if they say sex and porn, there's going to be a few different questions about that in terms of how long have they thought it was a problem, the extent of it, and why now. Usually it's going to be discovery, like their partner found something, but that's our kind of process that we do.
Nice. Well, and I think that's a great, I mean, assessing motivation is so important. I have a lot of men that I work with that we discover, you know, somewhere through the first session that they don't really give a shit about therapy. They don't want to be there. They're just trying to keep their marriage alive. And at some point we'll joke that they're voluntold to be here. But when you can kind of address that right off the bat, you know, it automatically kind of drops some barriers, and we can kind of laugh about it, right? That maybe we're not ready, or maybe we're getting pushed through the door. So I think that's a really smart way of starting off right away, knowing how motivated is this client.
Yeah, and I always tell them, listen, there's no bad choices. There's just different consequences, right? And so as long as you're aware of the consequences you're picking up, we're all good. And then I let them know, like, where you focus your attention is a reflection of what's important to you. So if this is really important to you, there are certain things you're going to need to be doing. Now, if you're not doing it, that's no problem. Let's just be clear. It's not that important to you. Right. So like, it's not a judgment. It's just like, let's just put the cards on the table. I'm here. I'm open. I'll take the money. You know, we'll do the session. But as long as we're on the same page of it's just not that important to you, I can't change that. You know what I mean? That's not in my power to make it important to them. But I always tell them not to worry, because pain will always bring them back, right? So, like, you know, eventually, there's no bad choice, just different consequence. And once that consequence is more painful than the joy that they get out of the behavior, well, then they're ready. So
that's a cool way of putting that. And I guess, can you talk a little bit about some of the consequences that you see with men's sexual behaviors and addictions?
Yeah, I mean, the primary one that's most painful, that my heart really sinks, is there's another partner involved. And when they're going through it, they know it intellectually, but they don't have the visceral experience. But something happens to a man when he sees the pain in his partner. And then that's a big part of therapy moving forward, because he so wants that pain to not be there in the partner, and the partner not to see them that way, right? But that is a huge one in terms of a consequence. You know, the pain there, if there's kids, the kids involved. But the bigger consequence, you know, the one that I share most regularly with my clients is like, listen, you could be an addict, a sex addict, and be like the wealthiest man in the world. You could create the most successful company, be an amazing artist. Like, there's no connection between an addiction and being outwardly successful. You're not going to get any of that here. It's not like, because now you dealt with your addiction, you'll be more successful or less successful. But what you can't have is you can't have a certain sense of inner peace and joy. That will elude you. So if you have an addiction and you then are super, super successful, no problem. You'll have the creature comforts. Just that inner piece of joy you'll never get. And so if that's something that's interesting and significant to you, then the work's going to be meaningful. And interestingly enough, because I do sex addiction, like the thing that the clients will report as like a feeling of, I can't believe how good this feels, is like they'll be driving with their partners and, you know, they're going somewhere and they're like, oh, you know what, can you put this in the phone, in my phone GPS, to see where we're going. And they give their phone to their partner and they're driving with that feeling. I get emotional because sometimes they get emotional, that there's nothing for them to hide on that phone. Like that feeling that comes from like not having to be worried, not having to say like, no, use your phone, don't use mine. You know, like, it's like, oh, and for them, it's like, I could live that way. And maybe for other people, this is a normal way to live, but for an addict, that's like, holy smokes, I could literally live where I don't have anything to hide. There's no real price on that.
I like that. Yeah, it's so simple, and there's no division of different parts of you being at odds, and there's just this cohesion, I guess, internally.
Exactly.
Well, I think that's a really important piece of wisdom to give to clients to help them buy into the process.
Yeah, because that's the majority of my work, is really just like, if there's anything I tell them that we can get out of working together, is just smash that denial, right? And just really smash it and accept that it's a symptom, not the main problem. Because if we don't have them bought in on that, there's not much. If they're just coming in like, oh, this week I didn't do X, I didn't watch pornography, or I didn't. But that's a big deal. If you're not doing the work to deal with the problem, I can assure you, eventually you're going to go back to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's so important to understand shame. And you've mentioned this a couple times. And I love I think it's Nathanson. I'll put it in the show notes. I forget the name, but it's the compass of shame. And there's kind of four directions that we go. And one of them is avoidance. And for men, I think that becomes a coping mechanism, denying, avoiding, minimizing. And we start to do that to ourselves sometimes, maybe not even consciously. So I know part of the process, at least in the work that I do with clients, is teaching them about shame, helping them understand shame. And I was wondering, can we touch on shame a little bit more, just in terms of the context of sex addiction and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the hallmark piece of the work. You know, the metaphor that I use for the men to kind of help them to understand it, you know, is I just use this metaphor of a fish born in polluted water. I'm like, if a fish were born in polluted water, the fish would have no idea that the reason it's unhealthy is because of the water, right? And so what I get them to start buying into is that these negative beliefs that you've carrying about yourself, you cannot see them. The reason you can't see them is because they've been with you your whole life. So for you, it's like that water, right? And so that's the second kind of pillar that I try to get them sold on. The first is symptom problem. The second is to smash completely the idea that they can do this alone. They can't do this alone because they can't see the water, right? They can't see the shame that's operating. Now, I'm very clear that they don't need a therapist. They could have a really good friend or whatever it is, as long as they are brutally honest and sharing the most honest parts of them. Because shame's primary intent is it wants to hide. So part of reducing shame is coming out of hiding. So for any addiction or the one I work on, coming to therapy is significant, but also being in some type of group, a 12-step group, another men's group, right? Because we're trying to find as many avenues to have shame reduction. And then the third piece. So the first piece is symptom, not the problem. The second piece is you can't do it alone. The third piece is the only way you're going to come to the negative core beliefs is through your emotional awareness. Your emotions are providing you information. And oftentimes you're going to get to see the negative core beliefs that are operating and start to see, can we put something in place to start the process of kind of challenging it? Right. So you mentioned earlier that one of the things is avoiding. Well, that's how my shame operated with the social media. It was exactly like that. Right. And so I had to sit in the pain, the emotional pain that I noticed at the idea of being on social media. For me, it was a lot of fear and a lot of shame, you know, and then I have to really make a different choice. Right. So that's kind of how we look at it. So it's a lot of kind of emotional awareness work. I'm sure if that makes sense. And then connect that with the body, just getting them comfortable with the body. So I'll do a lot of like closed eye work. Like, what are you feeling first in the body? What's the sensation?
Nice. I think the emotional awareness is that alone takes a lot of time with certain clients, especially with that trauma history, because I think we get so disconnected from our bodies. Like you're saying, helping them to kind of notice what's happening. And I guess I can maybe throw in a little personal bit here about my own therapy. You know, prior to going to therapy in my early 20s, I had gone almost a decade without crying. And I was getting frustrated. Like I'd be at funerals, you know, I'd well up, but something would happen inside and I wasn't aware of it. So through therapy, I developed more emotional awareness and also cognitive awareness to realize I've got this voice in my head that when I'm starting to become sad and upset, that voice tells me, don't cry, stop, that's weak, you look stupid, guys don't cry, right? Like all those messages that we're probably most of us grow up hearing, you know, we only feel anger, take it out on the field kind of thing. But it was only through therapy that I can now allow myself, like it's like I can give myself permission to be sad and to express emotion through tears. And so I think for so many of us, the messaging, the growing up, the culture, socialization, all those things really don't set us up to be able to be aware of our emotions and let alone express them in healthy ways.
Yeah, big time.
So I'm glad you mentioned the emotional awareness. I think that's a bulk of it.
Yeah. I mean, during my process, I remember being told like, you know, Eric, you're always in your head. And I had no idea what was meant by that. And then I was being instructed to be more mindful of what's going on in my body as a physical sensation. And I went through a period that for a long time I was single and I used to travel often on my own. And I, you know, I mentioned I journaled all the time and I would always talk about like this pain in my chest. Like I feel a tightness in my chest, a tightness in the chest. And one day I was traveling and I was like writing where I was and I was like, I'm lonely. I'm like, that's what the pain in my chest is. I'm lonely. Like I, for me, it was like a revelation. I didn't even know, you know what I mean? I just was like, this is what I do. And, but it all had to come from like trusting that, okay, wait, my body, there's something, I could feel something in my body like that I could buy into. And yeah. I was like, what is that? And then it was like, oh, okay, wait, what do I do with that? Oh shit, I'm sad. And then it was like, I could call somebody. I'd be like, I'm lonely, you know?
That was my only memory. We had like a check engine light that popped up like, oh, this is the lonely light here. And
exactly.
It's low and we got to go here to top that up. And it's just, we're so much more complicated than that. But
it's interesting you say that because that's what I tell my clients about emotional awareness. It's like a check engine light. So most men, what they do, so the check engine light is providing data. Most men, what they do with their emotions is the check engine light comes on and they cover it. And I said, you can still keep driving the car, but eventually another light is going to come on and then they're going to cover that. And eventually the car is going to crash, right? Because there's been so much data that you haven't been collecting, right? And so I really try to get them spot in on like your emotions are nuggets of data. And I work with a lot of men that come from a business background and that kind of language resonates because it's like, today in the business language, if you're not looking at your data, you're not running a business. You know what I mean? So same thing with the human organism.
And do you find working with men that a lot of them are maybe similar to the way you were, just really up in their head and unaware of their body, unaware of feelings?
I have the kind of two extremes, all right, which is part of the whole setup. So I have the more kind of traditional, you know, the guy that believes patriarchy, male dominance, alpha male, he believes like that's how you should be in the world. And he's the one you're talking about, much more kind of disconnected. And then I have the other extreme that's connected the patriarchy with masculinity. Like they've made it one and the same. And they said, it's all bad because I don't want to be that way. And like they're deep into emotions, but then they're not accessing the ones that they don't like. So anger, they don't want to touch that. They're people pleasers. They're not being assertive, right? So I kind of, when they come in, I got to figure out, okay, where is this guy on that spectrum? And so one of the questions I will always ask is, how do you feel about yourself as a man in terms of whatever you define that to mean for yourself? And I tell them, I'm not interested in the definition, but whatever definition you have in your head, how do you feel about yourself vis-a-vis that definition? And often so much shame comes up. I'm inadequate, I'm weak, I'm a loser, I'm not strong enough. And it's like, okay, we start to see that some of the shame starts to boil up.
Interesting. Well, and you're such an easy guy to talk to. I imagine that people sort of relax a little bit when they start getting into a session with you. But I'm curious, what do you do to build relationships, or what do you do to help men be more vulnerable?
I mean, the philosophical approach that I employ is what I call congruency. I do not think my words really make a difference. For me, it's about the fact that, and I tell them, whatever I'm sharing with you, I'm practicing in my own life. Does it mean I've got it? No, but I'm committed to practicing it. A perfect example is the social media. I'm practicing being aware that I have the shame and I'm practicing my ability to challenge on it. And I let them know first up. So A, that everything I'm sharing, I'm trying to practice in my own life. And then the second is to be clear that me and my client were equals, right? They're in the empowered chair. So they drive where they want to go, not want to go. But the thing I try to bring is just a congruency, you know, just about my words and my actions are lining up. And I think at some level, the guys can feel that like, I'm there because I care, but I'm not like altruistic in terms of I've got my business part of it. This is how I pay for myself. And there's no qualms about that. There's no shame that I'm happy. You know, I think you could do both, have a successful business and manage a practice. Like, so for example, my clients know straight up, I have a cancellation fee, I don't waiver. And so I tell them the first session, I said, listen, something's going to happen and you're not going to like it. And so, but I'm letting you know, this is where I'm at, because I can't be talking to you about healthy assertiveness and I'm not asserting myself. Like, for me, there's no connection there. Right. So, you know, unless someone died or something serious happened, and I said, I'm willing to lose you as a client. Like, if you feel so upset about it, because I got to stay with my congruency. And so that's, but they know going in, right? They know from the head of the game that this is how that's going to unfold.
Well, not just great communication and great boundary modeling right off the bat as well.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about self-disclosure. I mean, you use the social media example. I know self-disclosure is kind of on a threshold, I guess. And I guess I love when men come in with like a sports hat or, you know, some sort of a sweater that says something, and we can start off conversation like, oh, you're a Leafs fan or Habs fan, and we can go that way. I mean, what type of ways do you connect with men in more informal, casual ways in the therapy office?
I'm very, very, very intentional about my self-disclosure. So, because for me, it's super important that this is not about me. And so what I will do is I will bring it in when I notice or I feel, okay, there's some therapeutic significance here. So for example, you know, let's say in my case, I'll bring an example that, you know, I have a gay client who, like, he was having a hard time, like, believing that I was supportive. You know, he saw me in this paradigm. And so it was very important for me not to move away from that. So just to have him kind of struggle with that. And I saw him really working, really working. And then finally, like, maybe 9 months in, you know, I shared to him about my history when my brother came out as gay, and how important that was to me and how important he is to me, you know. But I would never, I'd never go, you know what I mean? I use it in that way that I'm very intentional, because I find sometimes, you know, therapists could be like, well, my experience validates that I have knowledge in this area. You know, I'm not sure 100%, you know what I mean? It validates that you have experience, but it might not be resonant with the client. So I try to be very intentional about it. That's basically my approach.
That's a good explanation. Let's talk a bit about toxic masculinity if we can.
Yeah. That's
a big buzzword these days.
Yeah. So from our philosophical point of view, I don't believe masculinity is toxic. So I don't believe in toxic masculinity. I believe what's toxic is patriarchy. So patriarchy is the idea of male dominance, and it's kind of what we grew up in. And that's the toxic piece. And that's the piece that what I'm trying to do is help it kind of find its death and die. Right. And so, but as I mentioned earlier, what we see is we have like two extremes generally. So men that equate masculinity with patriarchy, and they strive to be that way. So they think of the Marlboro man, the macho guy, the alpha male. So they think that's what it means to be a man, right? So they've connected patriarchy, male, this old way of seeing the world. And then as a result, if you have to live that way, there's no openness to vulnerability. There's no openness to feelings. Anger is maybe more present, right? So that's one area of men that we see, right? So they want to be that traditional alpha male. The other extreme that we see is they too have equated patriarchy, male dominance, with masculinity. But they say patriarchy is bad and masculinity is bad, and they throw it all out. So just like femininity, which there's so many inherent wonderful qualities, it's the same with masculinity. But then what happens with these men is that they're walking in the world where they're not accessing their anger. they're not kind of being assertive, right? And that's creating a whole set of pain. So what I'm generally trying to do is bring the men to the middle. And what I suggest is the middle is I suggest healthy masculinity is actually not associated with the word power, courage, strength. I equate it with the word love. And so what we're trying to do is get men to kind of have a masculinity that's rooted in love, but not in a sentimental love. If you really love someone, you would assert yourself to let them know where you're at with them. That's love. That's really, really hard. If you're raging and from that pain, you want to hurt someone, and you have the courage to challenge that and realize that this says more about you than the other person, that's love, right? And so it's not a sentimental love, but I don't at all like, because when I think of toxic masculinity, I think of my nephew. I'm like, you know, he's now getting older, he's 17, but when he was a young boy, I was like, how's he supposed to decide which part of his masculinity is toxic and which isn't? Like, well, how does, you know, he told me, you know, he was like, you know, he started, you know, meeting and dating, and he's like, I have to be sensitive, but not too sensitive. And I was like, Nicholas, how would you know where the line is? Like, how would you, right? Because he's trying to straddle this whole concept of what, and so I don't see any part of masculinity that's toxic. I see patriarchy as being toxic. And I also see patriarchy as a limited approach to how we see and how we live in the world, right? Because we need to be mindful. Our parents, our grandfathers, our forefathers, they grew up in that context. So men don't want to talk disparaging about, you know, their fathers and their grandfathers, right? Our grandfathers, they were born in a more limited way of living in the world. Now we've expanded it where we don't have to hold on to that old ideal. And so we could celebrate the equality between genders, which is what, as my practice, we're all about, right? Like, it's all about celebrating gender equality. And so many men are in fear of gender equality, right? And so we're trying to work to challenge that, meaning like, hey, this is an amazing thing.
How do you challenge those old ways of thinking? Or I imagine the way that we idolize our fathers, our grandfathers, that could be a barrier that you have to help them break through a little bit, those ideologies.
Yeah. I mean, the way I focus on it is the language I use is I just take a look at where are they losing power in their life. Right. And because when I think of a healthy masculinity, I think of it as an integrated whole where you still feel strong and powerful, but you would never have to hurt anybody to feel that way. Right. And so they're losing power, whether maybe they're completely acting on their anger or whether they're completely negating their feeling of anger. Right. So depending where the guy's at, I'm going to try to bring him to where I think would be appropriate for him to step in that more authentic whole, whole, OLE. And so really, and so I do a lot of anger work, you know, and a lot of the guys, it's hard for them to wrap their head around that it's a sign of weakness, right? Like that, like for them, it's like, no, if I don't act in anger, I'm the weak one, you know, but realizing, well, no, if you're acting from anger, that can only be weak. You know what I mean? And so not the emotion, you know, that is so much of the work that I do. Anger is healthy. If a guy comes in and I'm not seeing any anger or never talking about anger, I know we have a problem. Right. So anger is an emotion. I would never judge someone for feeling happy or joy. So anger is super healthy. I want that in the office. What someone decides to do with their anger, whether they're raging or passive aggressive, those are problems because they create distance. But the anger itself as an emotion is just a wonderful emotion. I tell my clients that I feel anger every day. Something stupid with my computer happens, I feel it. You know, now what do I do with it? You know, I don't ruin the rest of my day, but I feel the anger. You know what I mean?
Nice. So there's the normalization of anger as a regular emotion, a core emotion, and it's about what we do with it rather than feeling it.
Yeah, and really in like embracing feeling this anger. and removing the judgment that you're feeling the anger. Like some people, I try to tell them, like, please don't think, like through therapy, like, I don't care if you're the Dalai Lama or the Pope, you're experiencing anger. Like there's no state of enlightenment where you're not experiencing anger. Maybe the state of enlightenment is once you experience the anger, you don't do, you're okay with it. You don't do anything about it. You move into a good place. But the experience of it, I don't care who you are, you're a human organism. It's coming. You know what I mean? And so it's really about how you start responding to it. So to bring that in, because a lot of the clients, they get this idea that, the way, once I'm healthy, I'm not going to experience anger. Well, it's not happening.
Well, that's I love it. And but I want to talk a little bit about burnout and vicarious trauma, because as a therapist you hear a whole lot of things in your day-to-day. So I'm curious what you do to protect yourself from that, or to mitigate it, or manage it. What are some tips or strategies that you use?
I mean, I spoke about congruency, and the thing I've always shared, like, I know this is going to sound odd, but I'm not trying to help people. That's not my goal, right? Because if my intention is to help people, if I don't have anybody to help, I'm in a bad place, right? So who's more needy? The person seeking help or the person needing to give help? My thing is not helping people. What I'm sharing is my experience, my training, and my love for this work. Now, my hope is that a positive consequence of it is they're going to get something out of it. But I'm genuinely not attached to that. Like, that has nothing to do with me. So I don't see myself with an intent to help. My hope is that that will be the outcome, but I'm not attached to the outcome. It's kind of like when I was in the corporate world, we weren't focusing on how much money we were making. We were focusing on doing what we thought was right to build the business. And we believed that the positive consequence would be we'd make money. Now we would track that, make sure that we're noticing that, as I do with my clients, are they getting what they want? But so I'm wondering, because I get confused, you know, when sometimes I'll be with like therapists and network, like there's this thing about wanting to help, and you know, and I don't have that in me. Like, I love my clients, but listen, if stuff doesn't work for them, it doesn't work for them. It's not, you know what I mean? And maybe that's what needs to happen. So I haven't had that, you know, I get that a question often, like, what do you do to, right? And I don't really feel that in that way. But also I have, again, it's all about congruency. Like, I have what I do. I have my daily practice that I do, you know, the spiritual practice that fits for me. I've got my health routine that I do. I'm pretty particular with my diet. But for me, this connects with the work. And I'll tell my clients, like, a lot of the work, I'm using my clinical experience, my training, and my intuition. And I find that if I'm not taking care of my physical health, my eating, my space, that like something with my intuition gets clouded. It's like the more clarity I have in terms of, you know, I feel really much better with that. And I need that for this type of work. And so that's how I deal with it. But I can't say I've been doing this for a bit now. I can't say I've had an experience where, you know, maybe I had two experiences in the office where I was really uncomfortable by what happened in the office. And immediately I called my clinical supervisor, like, hey, I need to jump on a call. But that worked for me. I didn't really kind of stop there.
I think that's good advice. I mean, not focusing on the outcome of how much this is helping is in some ways a boundary for you to not be disappointed or not get too wrapped up in the results, and just more focusing on the process.
Yeah, exactly. And just to be clear, I'm obviously tracking if they're feeling that they're getting the support they need, right? But that's just to, you know, make sure we have some way to look at the efficacy of what we're doing, but not because if they're doing great, oh my God, this is such a big reflection on me. Like, you know what I mean? That's not how I see it.
Nice. So it separates that from being personal.
That's how I feel it. And maybe some clients will feel that as me being distant, right? Like I'm not like like an overly affectionate, like one young client came to the second session and he was told his parents, he's like, oh, my therapist is so amazing. He wasn't compassionate at all. You know what I mean? And like for him it was because he had seen so many therapists that were like coddling. And I was like, well, what do you want to change? Like, what do you want to change? Like he was giving me, and I was like, I didn't hear, like, what do you want to change? And he was getting upset in office, but I was like, I can't work if we don't address what you want to change. I know about your history, but that's not going to do anything if you don't want to change anything. You know?
Nice. I like putting the control back in their hands, which is really empowering. And I want to talk about your mission statement, just, you know, Men's Therapy Toronto. Part of what you're doing is to encourage men to consider psychotherapy as a profession.
Yeah, this is so big. I mean, it's my biggest issue in my practice. It's not clients, it's getting appropriate clinicians. But this is connected with this idea that men don't ask for help. So we've bought into this idea that men don't ask for help, which I think is potentially a myth. Okay. The challenge is, as a result of buying into that, we don't feel the need to take other necessary actions. So if we believe all men were seeking help, then what we would do is we would probably start saying, hey, we need to get more male therapists in the profession because there's a lot of men coming for help, right? And we would actively be promoting it, right? So the example is, you know, when I was a kid, it was very common that they said with young girls that young girls don't like math and science. And as a result, they don't go into engineering. And then we challenged that. We said, that doesn't make any sense. That's our patriarchal view of women that we need to change. So we saw that how we saw women was the problem. And then once we saw that, we said, what are we going to do to promote this profession among young girls? And now we're benefiting. There are so many talented, brilliant young women who are in, you know, a science-related profession. But that was as a result of our committed effort to say, A, we don't believe that women are not into this, and B, as a result of us changing that belief, we're going to start communicating and promoting this. And so I feel that A, we need to start reevaluating, is this really true that men don't ask for help? Is it possible we don't do a great job of making it accessible? And furthermore, would it not might be helpful if we just promote this profession to men in terms of an honorable profession, something where you can make money and also feel really good about what you're doing? And so that's a big part of our DNA. It's hard because there's so many different balls up in the air in terms of from a business point of view, but just like literally working with the universities, we haven't started yet. We're starting with getting the practicum students, but hey, what are we going to do to promote this among men? Because the numbers are staggering. It's like the College of Registered Psychotherapists, it's 80%. They put out the data, 80% women, 20% men, right? And so, and I would invite, because if we flip the switch, you know, imagine all the counseling centers in North America were predominantly staffed by men. So just imagine everywhere you went. And then how many women would feel comfortable going in there? Now, of course, gender plays no part in the efficacy of therapy. No part. You're not, whether it's a male or female makes no difference, but it plays a part in the client decision-making process. So a client, a female client may say, I would be much more comfortable working with a woman. So it does play a part on that, but same thing with a male client. But in today's climate, if a male client feels that way, there's so few therapists to kind of reach out to. And so that was the whole idea. So the whole idea for Men Therapy Toronto was, I was like, oh, you know what? I think this is a myth. I think it's not actually true that men don't ask for help. I think the bigger issue is that we don't make services accessible to them. And then the next step I said is, and in a language that they would resonate with. And then the next step, that's why I called it Men Therapy Toronto, just so that when a man lands on our website or however he finds us, just by the name, he knows another man's been there. right? So it kind of breaks that boundary. So that's, yeah, so that's really important. And I mean, just the fact that you're having this conversation, the more information for guys to know that this is a valid, you know, honorable profession, and we need more male role models, particularly for the young boys. I mean, what are we telling these young boys? It's as if we, it's the expectation is like they've already got it figured out. You know what I mean?
I think that's so true. And so many clients will reach out to me, parents, saying, you know, my son, I've got a 12, 13 year old. He's only comfortable talking to men. And I think so your point about accessibility is so true. It's just getting them in the door is so important. And when you have a center like Men Therapy Toronto, that just that makes it so much more accessible for young and older males just to get that help. So that's awesome. I think what you're doing is amazing. And I guess just my last question, just on that note, what advice do you have for new male therapists that are maybe thinking about getting into the field, or maybe they're going into a master's program, or just graduating? Like, do you have any wisdom that you can share with them?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say it from this way. It's not really in a business way, but use your life as the experiment in terms of like, you're going to be hearing so many different concepts. You're going to be going through so many different things. Like, really just start experimenting with your life in terms of, hey, what works for me? What doesn't work for me? But really get in there. If you haven't done therapy, you gotta be in there. And I would invite, man, touch as much. I used to go to AA meetings. I personally don't have any problem drinking, right? But the open meetings, just because I wanted to, like, what is this all about? And then I started reading the literature. I'm like, man, this is fascinating stuff. How can I apply this in areas of my life? So it would be really to start experimenting and really using yourself as a tool to kind of, like, I think that's super, super, super important.
Cool. I love that. That's awesome. Well, it's been so great talking to you, Eric, and I really appreciate you taking some time to share all this great information and knowledge and everything that you're doing in Toronto. How can people find you if they want to get in touch, if they want to check out your website?
Yeah, the website is mentherapytoronto.com. And now you can find us readily on social media. So just look for that and I'll be there. We'll be active and posting. So right, you'll be helping me reduce my shames. So I appreciate it.
That's amazing. So you're on Twitter, you're on Instagram, Facebook, all the
yeah, and LinkedIn. I mean, I'm not ready for TikTok. I was like, there's a line. I can't cross that line. Like that now, this is out of my league. I'm going to let that one go.
Yeah, TikTok, you're doing dance moves. Like, you're really putting yourself out there.
I can't go there. I do have a line.
Well, maybe next year I'll check in with you. That might change.
There you go.
Awesome, man. Okay. It's so good to talk to you.
You too.
This episode is brought to you by Rebel Office, an online resource center for entrepreneurs, including mentorship, strategy building, and graphic and web design services. To get in touch with Rebel Office about elevating your practice, visit rebeloffice.ca and use the promo code SocialWorkMe to be eligible for over 50% off your first session.